This is Audible.
Day Street Books and Harper Audio present The Dirt, Confessions of the World's Most Notorious Rock Band by Tommy Lee, Vince Neil, Nikki Sixx, and Mick Mars. Read by Sebastian York, Roger Wayne, Fred Berman, McLeod Andrews, and Hillary Hubert.
Dedicated to our wives and children, in the hope that they may forgive us for what we've done. Part 1. The Motley House. Chapter 1. Vince. Of and concerning the first house, wherein Tommy is caught with his knickers down and his baubles in a hole, Nikki is set on fire to the eminent displeasure of the carpet, Vince covets narcotics on the person of David Lee Roth, and Mick maintains a righteous and bemused distance. Her name was Bullwinkle. We called her that because she had a face like a moose. But Tommy, even though he could get any girl he wanted on the Sunset Strip, would not break up with her. He loved her and wanted to marry her, he kept telling us, because she could spray her cum across the room. Unfortunately, it wasn't just cum she sent flying around the house. It was dishes, clothes, chairs, fists, basically anything within reach of her temper. Up until then, and I'd lived in Compton, I'd never seen anyone get that violent. One wrong word or look could cause her to explode in a jealous rage. One night, Tommy tried to keep her away by jamming the door to the house shut. The lock was long since broken from being repeatedly kicked in by the police, and she grabbed a fire extinguisher and threw it through the plate glass window to get inside. The police returned later that night and drew their guns on Tommy, while Nikki and I hid in the bathroom. I'm not sure which we were more scared of, Bullwinkle or the cops. We never repaired the window. That would have been too much work. People would pour into the house, located near the Whiskey A Go-Go, for after-hours parties, either through the broken window or the warped, rotting brown front door, which would only stay closed if we folded a piece of cardboard and wedged it underneath. I shared a room with Tommy, while Nikki, that fucker, got the big room to himself. When we moved in, we agreed to rotate, and every month a different person would get the solo room. But it never happened. It was too much work. It was 1981, and we were broke, with 1,000 7-inch singles that our manager had pressed for us and a few decimated possessions to our name. In the front room sat one leather couch and a stereo that Tommy's parents had given him for Christmas. The ceiling was covered with small round dents, because every time the neighbors complained about the noise, we'd retaliate by pounding on the ceiling with broom handles and guitar necks. The carpet was filthy with alcohol, blood, and cigarette burns, and the walls were scorched black. The place was crawling with vermin. If we ever wanted to use the oven, we had to leave it on high for a good 10 minutes to kill the regiments of roaches crawling around inside. We couldn't afford pesticides, so to exterminate the roaches on the walls, we would take hairspray, hold a lighter to the nozzle, and torch the bastards. Of course, we could afford, or afford to steal, important things like hairspray, because you had to have your hair jacked up if you wanted to make the rounds at the clubs. The kitchen was smaller than a bathroom and just as putrid. In the fridge, there'd usually be some old tuna fish, beer, Oscar Mayer bologna, expired mayonnaise, and maybe hot dogs if it was the beginning of the week and we'd either stolen them from the liquor store downstairs or bought them with spare money. Usually, though, Big Bill, a 450-pound biker and bouncer from the Troubadour, who died a year later from a cocaine overdose, would come over and eat all the hot dogs. We'd be too scared to tell him it was all we had. There was a couple who lived down the street and felt sorry for us, so every now and then they'd bring over a big bowl of spaghetti. When we were really hard up, Nikki and I would date girls who worked in grocery stores just for the free food. But we always bought our own booze. It was a matter of pride. In the kitchen sink festered the only dishes we owned, two drinking glasses and one plate, which we'd rinse off now and then. Sometimes there was enough crud caked on the plate to scrape a full meal from, and Tommy wasn't above doing that. Whenever the trash piled up, we'd open the small sliding door in the kitchen and throw it onto the patio. In theory, the patio would have been a nice place, the size of a barbecue and a chair, but instead there were bags of beer cans and booze bottles piled up so high that we'd have to hold back the trash to keep it from spilling into the house every time we opened the door. The neighbors complained about the smell and the rats that had started swarming all over our patio, but there was no way we were touching it. Even after the Los Angeles Department of Health Services showed up at our door with legal papers requiring us to clean the environmental disaster we had created. Our bathroom made the kitchen look immaculate in comparison. In the 9 or so months we lived there, we never once cleaned the toilet. Tommy and I were still teenagers. We didn't know how. There'd be tampons in the shower from girls the night before, and the sink and mirror were black with Nikki's hair dye. We couldn't afford, or were too lazy to afford, toilet paper, so there'd be shit-stained socks, band flyers, and pages from magazines scattered across the floor. On the back of the door was a poster of Slim Whitman. I'm not sure why. Outside the bathroom, a hallway led to two bedrooms. The hall carpet was spotted with charred footprints because we'd rehearsed for our live shows by setting Nikki on fire, and the lighter fluid always ended up running down his legs. The bedroom Tommy and I shared was to the left of the hallway, full of empty bottles and dirty clothes. We each slept on a mattress on the floor draped with one formerly white sheet that had turned the color of squashed roach. But we thought we were pretty suave because we had a mirrored door on our closet. Or, we did. One night David Lee Roth came over and was sitting on the floor with a big pile of blow, keeping it all to himself as usual, when the door fell off the hinges and cracked across the back of his head. Dave halted his monologue for a half second and then continued. He didn't seem to be aware that anything out of the ordinary had happened, and he didn't lose a single flake of his drugs. Nikki had a TV in his room and a set of doors that opened into the living room, but he had nailed them shut for some reason. He'd sit there on the floor writing Shout at the Devil while everyone was partying around him. Every night after we played the whiskey, half the crowd would come back to our house and drink and do blow, smack, Percodin, Quaaludes, and whatever else we could get for free. I was the only one shooting up back then, because a spoiled rich, bisexual, menage a trois loving, 280Z-owning blonde named Lovey had taught me how to inject coke. There would be members of punk scene remnants like 45 Grave and the Circle Jerks coming to our almost nightly parties, while guys in metal newborns like Rat and Wasp spilled out into the courtyard in the street. Girls would arrive in shifts. One would be climbing out the window while another was coming in the door. Me and Tommy had our window and Nikki had his. All we'd have to say is, "Somebody's here, you have to go." And they'd go. Although sometimes they'd only go as far as the room across the hall. One chick who used to come over was an obnoxiously overweight redhead who couldn't even fit through the window, but she had a Jaguar XJS, which was Tommy's favorite car. He wanted to drive that car more than anything. Finally, she told him that if he fucked her, she'd let him drive the Jaguar. That night, Nikki and I walked into the house to find Tommy with his spindly legs flat on the floor and this big, naked, quivering mass bouncing mercilessly up and down on top of him. We just stepped over him, grabbed a rum and coke, and sat on our decimated couch to watch the spectacle. They looked like a red Volkswagen with four white wall tires sticking out the bottom and getting flatter by the second. The second Tommy finished, he buttoned up his pants and looked at us. "I gotta go, man," he beamed, proud. "I'm gonna drive her car." Then he was off. Through the living room crud, out the busted front door, past the cinder blocks, and in the car, pleased with himself. It would not be the last time we found those two embraced in the devil's bargain. We lived in that pigsty as long as a child stays in the womb before scattering to move in with girls we had met. The whole time we lived there, all we wanted was a record deal. But all we ended up with was booze, drugs, chicks, squalor, and court orders. Mick, who was living with his girlfriend in Manhattan Beach, kept telling us that was no way to go about getting a deal. But I guess he was wrong. That place gave birth to Motley Crue. and like a pack of mad dogs, we abandoned the bitch, leaving with enough reckless aggravated testosterone to spawn a million bastard embryo metal bands.
Chapter 2. Mick. The house, perceived from an outside perspective, in which the correlation between Bullwinkle and extraterrestrial life forms is postulated. I used to tell them, you know what your problem is? When you do stuff, you get caught. This is the way you do stuff. And I took a shot glass and threw it across the room, and nobody knew what the fuck was going on. I've always been the one who knows how to do things like that and not get caught. I guess I was the outsider. I had this place in Manhattan Beach with my girlfriend. I was never into hanging out at that house. I had done that, seen it. I'd been over 21 for a long time, and they were still like 18. I came over once for Christmas, and they had a small tree they'd stolen and decorated with beer cans, panties, snot, needles, and shit. Before we left for a gig at the country club that night, they put the tree in the courtyard, doused it with gasoline, and set it on fire. They thought it was real funny, but to me, it just stank. That kind of stuff bored me really quickly, you know? It was always so filthy over there that you could wipe your finger on any surface and get dirt under your nails. I'd rather stay home and drink and bang on my guitar. Nikki was going out with some kind of witch who he'd have sex with in the closet or in a coffin in her house. Tommy was going out with, I can't remember her name, but we called her Bullwinkle. And a moose isn't a very pretty animal. She'd go crazy and rip fire extinguishers off the walls and bust through windows to get into the house. To me, she was a dumb, young, possessive personality that was crazy or something. I could never get as violent as that, shatter a window and run the risk of hurting myself. What's on the inside of people like that is stuff that's a little too much for me. Everyone likes to look for aliens, but I think we are the aliens. We're the descendants of the troublemakers on other planets. Just like Australia was a prison to England, where they sent all their criminals and so on, it's the same thing on Earth. This is where they dropped us off. We're the insane fucking people from somewhere else. Just a bunch of trash. My back hurts.
Part 2. Born Too Loose. Chapter 1. Nikki. The trials and travails of young Nikki, in which our hero is savagely beaten for brushing his teeth in an ill-advised direction. Learns the finer points of rabbit slaughter, utilizes a lunchbox in self-defense, holds hands with sweet Sarah Hopper, and sells crank. I was 14 years old when I had my mother arrested. She was mad at me over something, staying out late, not doing homework, playing music too loud, dressing like a slob I can't remember, and I couldn't take it anymore. I smashed my bass against the wall, threw my stereo across the room, tore my MC5 and Blue Cheer posters off the wall, and kicked a hole in the black and white television downstairs before slamming the front door open. Outside, I systematically threw a rock through every window in the townhouse. But that was just the beginning. I'd been planning what came next for some time. I ran to a nearby house filled with degenerates I liked to get stoned with and asked for a knife. Someone tossed me a stiletto. I popped out the blade, extended my bracelet-covered left arm, and plunged the knife in directly above the elbow, sliding it downward about 4 inches and deep enough in some places to see bone. I didn't feel a thing. In fact, I thought it looked pretty cool. Then I called the police and said my mother had attacked me. I wanted them to lock her away so I could live alone, but my plan backfired. The police said that if, as a minor living in her custody, I pressed charges, they'd have to put me in a juvenile home until I was 18. That meant I wouldn't be able to play guitar for 4 years. And if I couldn't play guitar for 4 years, that meant I'd never make it. And I was going to make it. There was no doubt about that, at least in my mind. So I struck a plea bargain with my mother. I told her I wouldn't press assault charges if she'd back off, leave me alone, let me be me. You haven't been there for me, I told her, so just let me go. And she did. I never came back. It was an overdue ending to a quest for escape and independence that had been set in motion a long time ago. It began like Richard Hell's punk classic Blank Generation. I was saying let me out of here before I was even born. I was born December 11th, 1958, at 7:11 a.m. in San Jose. I was as early as I could be, and even back then, probably still up from the night before. My mother had about as much luck with names as she had with men. She was born Deanna Haight, an Idaho farm girl with stars in her eyes. She was witty, strong-willed, motivated, and extremely gorgeous, like a 50s movie star with stylishly short hair, an angelic face, and a figure that inspired double takes in the street. But she was the black sheep of the family, the exact opposite of her perfect, pampered sister, Sharon. She had an untamable wild streak, completely capricious, prone to random adventure, and constitutionally unable to create any pattern of stability. She was definitely my mother. She wanted to name me either Michael or Russell, but before she could, the nurse asked my father, Frank Carlton Ferrana, who was just a few years away from leaving her and me for good, what I should be called. He betrayed my mother on the spot and named me Frank Ferrana after himself. And that's what they wrote on the birth certificate. From the first day, my life was a clusterfuck. At that point, I should have crawled right back in and begged my maker, "Can we start over?" My father stuck around long enough to give me a sister who, like my father, I have no memories of. My mother always told me that my sister had gone to live somewhere else when she was young, and I wasn't allowed to see her. It wasn't until 30 years later that I discovered the truth. For my mother, pregnancy and children were warning signs telling her to slow down, advice she heeded for only a short time until she started dating Richard Pryor. For most of my childhood, the idea of a sister and a father was beyond my comprehension. I never thought of myself as coming from a broken home because I had no memories of home being anything other than my mother and me. We lived on the 9th floor of the St. James Club, then known as the Sunset Towers, on Sunset Boulevard. And whenever I got in the way of her lifestyle, she'd ship me to stay with my grandparents who were constantly on the move, living in a cornfield in Pocatello, Idaho, or a rock park in Southern California, or a hog farm in New Mexico. My grandparents constantly threatened to take legal custody of me if my mother didn't stop partying. But she would neither relinquish me completely nor slow down. The situation took a turn for the worse when she joined Frank Sinatra's band as a backup singer and started dating the bassist, Vinny. I'd watch them rehearse all the time, with stars of the era like Mitzi Gaynor, Count Basie, and Nelson Riddle passing through. When I was 4, she married Vinny, and we moved to Lake Tahoe, which was becoming a mini Las Vegas. I'd wake up at 6 in the morning in the little brown house where we lived, ready to play, but I'd end up alone, skipping rocks in the pond outside until they got out of bed around 2 p.m. I knew not to try and wake Vinny, because he'd knock me out. He was always in a terrible mood, and at the slightest provocation would take it out on me. One afternoon, he was taking a bath when he noticed me brushing my teeth from side to side instead of up and down, as he had taught me. He stood up, naked, hairy, and beaded with water like an ape caught in a hailstorm, and smashed his fist into the side of my head, knocking me to the ground. Then my mother, as usual, turned red and attacked him while I ran to the pond to hide. That Christmas, I received 2 presents. My father stopped by our house while I was outside playing, and as either a feeble gesture to absolve his guilt or a genuine effort to be a father with the little means available to him, left me a red plastic circular sled with leather handles. And my half-sister, Cece, was born. We moved to Mexico when I was 6, either because my mother and Vinny had made enough money to take a year's sabbatical, or because they were running from something, most likely someone in a blue uniform. They never told me why. All I remember is that my mother and Cece flew there, which meant that I had to cross the border in the Corvair with Vinny and Belle. Belle was his German shepherd who, much like Vinny, constantly attacked me for no reason. My legs, arms, and torso were covered with bite marks for years. To this day, I still can't fucking stand German Shepherds. It somehow makes sense that Vince just bought one for himself. Mexico was probably the best time of my childhood. I ran around naked with the Mexican kids on the beach near our cottage, played with the goats and chickens roaming the neighborhood like they owned it, ate ceviche, went into town for fire-cooked corn ears wrapped in tinfoil, and at the age of 7, smoked pot for the first time with my mother. When Mexico grew stale for them, we returned to Idaho, where my grandparents bought me my first phonograph, a gray plastic toy that only played singles. It had a needle on the lid, so whenever it was closed, the song played, and when it was open, it stopped. I used to listen to Alvin and the Chipmunks all the time, which my mother had never let me forget. A year later, we all piled into a U-Haul trailer and headed for El Paso, Texas. My grandfather slept in a sleeping bag outside, my grandmother napped in a seat, and I curled up on the floor like a dog. At the age of 8, I was already sick of touring. After so much traveling, spending most of my time in the company of myself, friendship became like television to me. It was something to flip on now and then to distract myself from the fact that I was alone. Whenever I was around a group of kids my age, I felt awkward and out of place. In school, I had trouble focusing. It was hard to care or pay attention when I knew that before the year was up, I'd be gone and never have to see any of those teachers or kids again. In El Paso, my grandfather worked at a Shell gas station, my grandmother stayed in the trailer, and I went to the local grade school where the kids were merciless. They pushed me, picked on me, and said I ran like a girl. Every day as I walked alone to school, I'd have to cross the high school yard and get pelted with soccer balls, footballs, and food. To further my humiliation, my grandfather cut my hair, which my mother had always let grow long, into a flat top, not the most popular style in the late 60s. I eventually grew to like El Paso because I started spending time with Victor, a hyperactive Mexican kid who lived across the street. We became best friends and did everything together, enabling me to ignore the scores of other kids who hated my guts because I was poor white California trash. But just as I began to get comfortable, the inevitable news came. We were moving again. I was devastated, because this time I would have to leave someone behind, Victor. We moved to the middle of the desert, in Anthony, New Mexico, because my grandparents thought they could make more money on a hog farm. We raised chickens and rabbits as well as pigs. My job was to take each rabbit, hold him by his hind legs, grab a stick, and smash it into the fur on the back of his head. His body would convulse in my hands, blood would drip out of his nose, and I'd stand there thinking, he was just my friend. I'm killing my friends. But at the same time, I knew that slaughtering them was my role in the family. It was what I had to do to become a man. School was a 90-minute bus ride of unpaved roads and constant bullying away. When we arrived, the older kids who sat in the back of the bus would push me to the ground and stand on me until I gave them my lunch money. After the first 7 times, I vowed that it would never happen again. The next day, it happened again. The following morning, I brought a metal Apollo 13 lunchbox with me and filled it with rocks at the bus stop. As soon as we arrived at school, I ran off the bus, and as usual, they caught up with me. But this time, I started swinging, breaking noses, denting heads, and sending blood everywhere, until the lunchbox broke open on connecting with the face of one inbred shit-kicker. They never fucked with me again, and I felt power. Instead of cowering around older kids, I'd just think, "Don't start with me, because I will fuck you up." And I did. If anyone pushed me, I'd fucking deck them. I was demented, and they all started to realize that and kept their distance. Instead of skipping stones when I was alone, I started walking down dirt roads with my BB gun, picking off all things animate and inanimate. My only friend was an old lady who lived in a trailer nearby, all alone in the middle of the desert. She'd sit on her faded, flower-patterned couch and drink vodka while I fed the goldfish. After a year of living in Anthony, my grandparents decided that raising pigs wasn't the road to riches they had thought it would be. When they told me we'd be moving back to El Paso, one block from our old house, I was ecstatic. I would get to see my friend Victor again. But I wasn't the same me anymore. I was bitter and destructive, and Victor had found new friends. I passed by his house at least twice a day, feeling my isolation and anger grow, before walking through the high school to get pelted with sports equipment on the way to the Gadsden District Junior High that I hated. I started stealing books and clothes from people's lockers out of spite, and going into the general store, Piggly Wiggly's, and swiping candy and sticking Hot Wheels in the 10-cent bags of popcorn, hoping people would choke on them. For Christmas, my grandfather sold some of his most prized possessions, including his radio and his only suit, just to buy me a buck knife, and I rewarded his sacrifice by using it to slash tires. Revenge, self-hate, and boredom had opened up the path to juvenile delinquency for me, and I chose to follow it to the very end. My grandparents eventually moved back to Idaho, to a 60-acre cornfield in Twin Falls. We lived next to a silage pit, which is where the extra husks and waste left over after harvesting were dumped, mixed with chemicals, covered with plastic, and left to rot in the ground until they stank enough to feed to the cows. I lived a Huckleberry Finn life that summer, fishing in the creek, walking along the railroad tracks, crushing pennies under trains, and building forts out of haystacks. Most evenings, I would run around the house pretending like I had a motorcycle, then lock myself in my room and listen to the radio. One night, the DJ played Big Bad John by Jimmy Dean, and I lost my mind. It cut through the boredom like a scythe. The song had style and attitude. It was cool. I found it, I thought. This is what I've been looking for. I phoned the station so much to request Big Bad John that the DJ told me to stop calling. When school started, it was like Anthony all over again. The kids picked on me, and I had to resort to my fists to stop them. They made fun of my hair, my face, my shoes, my clothes. Nothing about me fit. I felt like a puzzle with a piece missing, and I couldn't figure out what that piece was or where I could find it. So I joined the football team because violence was the only thing that gave me any sense of power over other people. I made the first string, and though I played both offense and defense, I thrived as a defensive end where I could just cream the quarterbacks. I loved hurting those motherfuckers. I was psycho. I'd get so worked up on the field, I'd whip my helmet off and start smashing other kids with it, just like it was my Apollo 13 lunchbox in Anthony. My grandfather still tells me, "You play rock and roll exactly like you played football." Through football came respect. And through football and respect came girls. They started noticing me, and I started noticing them. But just when I was finally starting to find a niche, my grandparents moved to Jerome, Idaho, and I had to start all over again. But this time, there was a difference. Thanks to Jimmy Dean, I had music. I'd listen to the radio 10 hours a day. Deep Purple, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Pink Floyd. However, the first record that I bought was Nilsson Schmilsson by Harry Nilsson. I had no choice. One of my first friends, a redneck named Pete, had a sister who was a tan, blonde, small-town hottie. She'd walk around in short cut-off jeans that sent me into convulsions of desire and panic. Her legs were golden arches, and every night in bed, all I could think about was how well I would fit between them. I'd follow her around like a clown, tripping over my own shoes. She hung out at a combination pharmacy, soda shop, and record store where, when I finally saved up enough money to buy Deep Purple's Fireball, she smiled at me with those big white teeth, and suddenly I found myself buying Nilsson Schmilsson because she had mentioned it. It was Jerome that started me down the alley that would lead to Alcoholics Anonymous years later, where, coincidentally, I met and became friends with Harry Nilsson. In fact, in a delusional state of sobriety, we actually talked about collaborating on an album. Jerome had the highest substance abuse rate per capita of any city in the United States, which was impressive for a town of 3,000. I also made friends with a fellow dork named Alan Weeks, and we spent most of our time in his house, listening to Black Sabbath and Bread, and staring at our school yearbook, talking about which girls we wanted to go out with. Of course, when it came down to it, we were pathetic. At high school dances, we just stood outside, listening to music, leak out the door and feeling uncomfortable when girls walked past, because we were too scared to dance with them. That spring, we heard that a local band was coming to play at our high school and bought tickets. The bass player had a huge afro and a headband like Jimi Hendrix, and the guitar player had long hair and a biker mustache like a Hell's Angel. They seemed so cool. They used real instruments, they had big amplifiers, and they held 300 kids spellbound in a gymnasium in Jerome. It was the first time I had seen a live rock band, and I was awestruck, though they were probably hating whoever booked them in a shitty small-town high school. I don't remember what they were called, what they sounded like, or whether they played cover songs or originals. All I knew was that they looked like gods. I was too goofy to ever have a chance with Pete's sister, so I settled for Sarah Hopper, a fat, freckled girl with glasses, no cut-off shorts, and legs that looked more like pasty semicircles than golden arches. Sarah and I would hold hands and walk around downtown Jerome, which was about one city block. Then we'd go to the pharmacy and look at the same records over and over. Sometimes, to impress her, I'd walk out with a Beatles album hidden under my shirt, and we'd listen to it at the immaculate house where her Quaker parents lived. One night, I was lying on my grandparents' avocado green carpet when their black Bakelite phone, which was used so rarely that it just hung on the wall with no chair or table around it, rang. "I want to give you a present," the voice on the other end, Sarah's, said. "Well, what is it?" I asked. "I'll give you the initials," she cooed into the receiver. "B.J. And I replied, "What's that?" "I'm babysitting. Just come over." As I walked to meet her, I mulled over the possibilities. A Billy Joel record. A baby Jesus figurine. A big joint. When I got there, she was wearing ill-fitting red lingerie that belonged to the woman who owned the house. "Do you want to go into the bedroom?" she asked, leaning with her elbow against the wall and her hand on her head. "Why?" I asked, like an idiot. So while the kids played in the room next door, I had sex for the first time and discovered that it was like masturbation, but a lot more work. Sarah, however, wasn't letting me off easy. She wanted it all the time. As her parents made cookies for us at her house, I'd bonk their daughter in the other room. While her parents were in church, Sarah and I would slip out to the car. That was the routine, until I came to a sudden realization that all men must face at least once during the course of their lives. I was bonking the ugliest girl in town. Why not step it up a notch? So I shed Sarah Hopper, and while I was at it, dumped Alan Weeks, too. And I didn't give a shit about how they felt because it was the first time I ever had the courage to believe I could rise above the bottom of the barrel. Instead, I started hanging out with the classy kids, like a 300-pound Mexican named Bubba Smith. I had gotten laid and started doing alcohol and drugs, which I thought made me look pretty hip, especially under the black lights I soon bought for my bedroom. And as anyone with a teenager in the house knows, once there are black lights in the bedroom, that kid is no longer yours. He belongs to his friends. Goodbye, chocolate chip cookies and Beatles. Hello, weed and Iron Maiden. I was still far from the coolest kids in Jerome. They had cars, we had bicycles, which we'd use to ride around the park and terrorize couples making out. I'd come home late, amped up on pot, and watch Don Kirshner's rock concert. And if my grandparents tried in any way to constrain or criticize me, I'd flip out. It was too much for them to handle night after night. So they sent me away to live with my mother, who had migrated with my half-sister Cece to the Queen Anne Hill area of Seattle, where they lived with her new husband, Ramon, a big, tender-hearted Mexican with a lowrider and slicked-back black hair. Here, finally, was a city crawling with creeps and degenerates, a city big enough to cater to my drug-taking, alcohol-drinking, music-obsessed state. Ramon listened to El Chicano, Chuck Mangione, Sly and the Family Stone, and all kinds of Hispanic jazz and funk, which, between tokes on a joint, he tried to teach me to play on a beat-up, out-of-tune acoustic guitar with a missing A string. We soon moved, of course, to an area nearby called Fort Bliss, a massive cluster of small four-apartment pod buildings for people on welfare. On my first day of school, instead of beating me up, my classmates asked if I was in a band, so I told them I was. I had to take two buses to school, and to kill time during the half-hour wait for the second bus, I'd stop by an instrument store called West Music. There was a beautiful Les Paul gold-top guitar hanging on the wall that had a clear, rich tone. When I played it, I tried to imagine that I was shredding up the stage with the Stooges, sending squealing guitar solos spiraling to the rafters as Iggy Pop convulsed at the microphone stand and the audience erupted like they did in that high school gym in Jerome. At school, I befriended a rocker named Rick Van Zant, a long-haired stoner who played in a band and had a Stratocaster guitar and a Marshall amp stack in his basement. He said he needed a bassist, but I had no instrument. So I walked into West Music one afternoon with an empty guitar case one of Rick's friends had loaned me. I asked for a work application, and when the guy turned around to find one, I stuck a guitar into the case. My heart was hammering through my shirt, and I could hardly speak when he handed me the form. As I examined it, I noticed that the price tag for the guitar was hanging out of the case. I told him I'd come back and drop off the application, and walked out as casually as I could, accidentally banging the conspicuous guitar case into walls, doors, and drum sets as I left. I had my first guitar. I was ready to rock, so I headed straight for Rick's basement. "You need a bassist?" I told him. "I'm your man." "You need a bass guitar," he sneered. "Beautiful," I replied, as I threw the case on a table, opened it up, and pulled out my newest possession. "That's a guitar, you fucking idiot." "I know," I lied. "I'll play bass on the guitar." "You can't do that." So I bid farewell to my first guitar and sold it, using the money to buy a shiny black Rickenbacker bass with a white pickguard. Every day, I'd try to learn the Stooges, Sparks, especially This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, and Aerosmith. I wanted so badly to join Rick's band, but they knew as well as I did that I couldn't play for shit. Besides, they were more into traditional big riff rockers like Ritchie Blackmore, Cream, and Alice Cooper, especially Muscle of Love. A guy across the street from him was starting a band called Mary Janes, so I tried to jam with him, but I was hopeless. All I could do was pick a note every 30 seconds or so and hope it was the right one. Finally, outside an 18 and over show I was trying to get into, I met a guy named Gaylord, a punk rocker who had his own apartment and band, the Vidiots. Every day after school, I'd go to his house and drink until I passed out, listening to the New York Dolls, the MC5, and Blue Cheer. There'd always been a dozen glammed-out New York Dolls-looking chicks and dudes there, wearing fingernail polish and eye makeup. They called us the Whiz Kids, not because we took a lot of speed, which we did, but because we were flashy dressers like David Bowie, whose Young Americans album had just come out. Like the mods in England, we'd sell drugs to buy clothes. I practically moved into Gaylord's and stopped going home. I did drugs all the time, pot, mescaline, acid, crank, and was soon a bona fide punk rock whiz kid selling drugs for them. I began dating a girl named Mary. Everybody used to call her Horsehead, but I liked her for one simple reason. She liked me. I was so happy that a girl actually talked to me. After weeks of drugs and rock and roll, I was cool but still pathetic. I had painted toe and fingernails, torn punk clothes, eye makeup, and a bass guitar I carried everywhere, even though I still couldn't play and wasn't in a band. We stood out and were ridiculed everywhere we went. At school, I'd get into fights because a group of black kids would call me Alice Bowie and block the hallway to keep me from passing. On the way home from school, I started casing houses. I'd knock on the door as I passed by, and if nobody answered 2 days in a row, the next afternoon I'd smash the back door in and grab whatever I could hide under my jacket. I'd come home from school with stereos, TVs, lava lamps, photo albums, vibrators, whatever I could find. In our complex, I'd ransack the basements in each apartment pod and break into the washing machines with a crowbar in search of quarters. I was angry all the time, partly because the drugs were fucking with my moods, partly because I resented my mother, and partly because it was the punk rock thing to do. Almost every day, I'd sell drugs, steal shit, get in fights, and fry on acid. I'd come home and lie on the couch tripping on Don Kirshner's rock concert until I passed out. My mother didn't know what was going on. Was I gay? Straight? A serial killer? An artist? A boy? A man? An alien? What? To tell the truth, I didn't know either. Every time I set foot in the house, we'd get in arguments. She didn't like what I was turning into, and I didn't like what she had always been. Then, one day, it happened. I couldn't take it anymore. On the streets, I was free and independent, but at home, I was supposed to be a kid. I didn't want to be a kid anymore. I wanted to be left alone. So I tore the place apart, stabbed myself, and called the police. It basically worked, because I was free of her afterward. I spent that night with my friend, Rob Hemphill, an Aerosmith freak who thought he was Steven Tyler. To him, Tyler was the punk that Mick Jagger could never be. After his parents kicked me out, I slept in Rick Van Zant's car. I'd try to wake up before his parents, but usually they'd leave the house to go to work and find me sleeping in the back seat. The third time they caught me, they called my mother. "What's going on with your son?" Mr. Van Zant asked. "He's sleeping in my car." "He's on his own," my mother said, and hung up. When I could, I went to school. It was a good way to make money. Between classes, I'd roll joints for kids, charging 50 cents for two. After 2 months of good business, the headmaster walked around the corner and caught me with a bag of weed in my lap. That was my last day of school. I'd been to 7 schools in 11 years and was fed up anyway. After being expelled, I spent my days under the 22nd Street Bridge, where all the other burnouts and dropouts killed time. I was going nowhere. I found a job at Victoria Station washing dishes and rented a one-bedroom apartment with 7 friends who had also dropped out of school. I stole another base, and for food, I'd wait by the garbage can outside Victoria Station until the busboys threw out meat scraps. I was quickly growing depressed. Just a year ago, I'd been ready to take over the world, and now my life was going nowhere. When I ran into my old friends like Rick Van Zant or Rob Hemphill or Horsehead, I felt alienated, like I had emerged from a gutter and was getting them filthy. I didn't feel like going to work, so I quit. When I couldn't afford rent anymore, I moved in with 2 prostitutes who felt sorry for me. I lived in their closet, hanging posters of Aerosmith's Get Your Wings and Deep Purple's Come Taste the Band on the walls to make it feel like home. I had nothing going for me. One day, I came home to my closet and my mother whores were gone. The landlord had kicked them out, so it was back to the Van Zant's car. Winter was fast approaching, and it was freezing cold at night. For money, I started selling chocolate-covered mescaline outside concerts. At a Rolling Stones show at the Seattle Coliseum, a freckle-covered kid came up to me and said, "I'll trade you a joint for some mescaline." I agreed because the mescaline was cheap, but as soon as I did, 2 cops burst out of a nearby car and handcuffed me. The kid was a narc. He and the cops dragged me, kicking and calling them names, underneath the Seattle Coliseum. For some reason, however, they didn't book me. They took my information, threatened me with a 10-year mandatory minimum in jail, and then let me go. They said if they ever saw me again, even if I wasn't doing anything wrong, they'd put me behind bars. I felt like my life was blowing up. I had nowhere to live, no one to trust, and after all this, I had never even played in a single band. In fact, as a musician, I sucked. Just weeks before, I had sold my only bass guitar for money to buy drugs to pedal. So I did the only thing a punk rocker who's hit rock bottom can do. I called home. "I have to leave Seattle," I pleaded with my mother, "and I need your help." "Why should I help you?" she asked coldly. "I just want to go see Grandma and Grandpa," I begged. The next day, my mother came to put me on a Greyhound bus. She didn't really want to see me again, but she didn't trust me with the money. She also wanted to remind me that she was a long-suffering saint for helping me, and I was a selfish jerk. But the only thing that I could think was, boom, I'm out of here and never coming back. All I had in the way of music for the ride was an Aerosmith tape, a Lynyrd Skynyrd tape, and a beat-up boombox. I listened to those cassettes over and over until I arrived in Jerome. I walked off the bus in 6-inch platform boots, a gray tweed double-breasted suit, a shag haircut, and fingernail polish. My grandmother's face turned white. Away from Seattle and my mother, I didn't cause any trouble. I worked on the farm, moving irrigation pipe, through the end of the summer. I saved the money I made and actually purchased a guitar, a fake Gibson Les Paul that they were selling in a gun shop for $109. My priggish Aunt Sharon visited the farm a couple of times with her new husband, a record executive in Los Angeles named Don Zimmerman. He was the president of Capitol Records, home of the Beatles and the Suite, and he began sending me cassettes and rock magazines. One day, after receiving his latest package, it dawned on me. Here I was listening to Peter Frampton in fucking Idaho, while in Los Angeles, the Runaways and Kim Fowley and Rodney Bingenheimer and the dudes from Cream Magazine were all partying at the hippest rock clubs imaginable. All this shit was going down over there, and I was missing it.
Chapter 2. Mick. Of Mick's delightful and happenstance encounter with a vendor of spirits. They were charging $2 for a shot of tequila at the Stone Pony, and I wasn't going to pay that. We should have been drinking for free that night since the southern rock band I was playing in was on the bill. They were originally called 10-Wheel Drive, but I told them that if they wanted me to join, they'd have to change their name. Now, we were Spiders and Cowboys, which, on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as band names go, gets a 4.9. In North Hollywood, I walked down Burbank Boulevard to Magnolia Liquor to get a half pint of cheap tequila. It was as cold as a witch's tit, and I stared at the ground the whole way, thinking about what I could do to teach Spiders and Cowboys about good music. I hadn't spent my life playing guitar and neglecting my kids, my family, my schoolwork, everything, just so I could end up playing in a southern rock band. When I walked into the store, the guy at the counter sneered, "You look like a rock and roller type." I couldn't tell whether he was complimenting me or making fun of me. I looked up and saw a kid with wild dyed black hair, messy makeup, and leather pants. I think I told him that he looked like a rock and roller too. I'm always on the lookout for people I can play with, so I decided to ask him a few questions and see if he had any potential. He had just moved here and was living with his aunt and uncle, who was a big shot at Capitol Records or something. His name was Frank, he played bass, and he seemed like an all right guy. But then he said he listened to Aerosmith and Kiss, and I can't stand Kiss. I never fucking liked them. I instantly crossed him off my list of possible people to play with. I was into good music, like Jeff Beck and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. "Listen," I told the kid, "if you want to see a real guitar player, come on down to the Stone Pony after work." He was an arrogant kid, and I didn't think he'd show up. Besides, he only looked to be about 17, so I doubted they'd let him in the door. In fact, I forgot all about him until I saw him during the show. I was playing slide guitar with the mic stand and doing all these insane solos, and his jaw just dropped open. Somebody walking by could have stepped on it. After the gig, we had a few drinks together and talked about the kind of shit that people who've drunk too much tequila talk about. I gave him my phone number. I don't know whether he ever tried to use it, because I went up to Alaska to do some gigs. I didn't care anyway. He liked Kiss.
Chapter 3. Nicky. The further adventures of young Nicky, his battle with a one-armed adversary, a sore prick, and other matters sufficiently entertaining. My Uncle Don hooked me up. He let me drive his powder blue Ford F-10 pickup with fat radial tires. He scored me a job at a record store, Music Plus, where the manager would stuff our noses full of cocaine. He took me shopping for bell-bottoms and capizios at the mall. He brought me Suite posters to paper my room with. And there was a crazy onslaught of new music everywhere. X, the Dills, the Germs, the Controllers. L.A. was what I'd been looking for, and I was going out of my mind. It would only be a matter of months before I blew it all and was homeless and unemployed again. At my uncle's, I felt like a punk rocker who had been dropped in the middle of a Leave It to Beaver rerun. His family led a clean-cut yuppie life in a perfect little house with a perfect little swimming pool. The kids would ride their bicycles outside until Mom called them in for dinner at dusk. They'd take off their shoes and wipe their feet and wash their hands and say grace and put their napkins in their laps. There are those of us who see life as a war and those who see it as a game. This family was neither. They preferred to sit on the side and watch it pass by from a distance. For me, it was a war. I had angst dripping out of my pores. I wore skin-tight red pants that laced up the front, capizios, and makeup. Even when I tried to fit in, I couldn't. One day, my cousin Ricky was kicking a ball around the yard with some friends, and I tried to join them. I just couldn't do it. I didn't remember how to kick or throw or stand or anything. I kept trying to motivate them to do something fun, like find some alcohol, run away, rob a bank, anything. I wanted to talk to somebody about why Brian Connolly of the suite had bangs that curled under, and I didn't. They just looked at me like I was from another planet. Then Ricky asked, "Are you wearing makeup?" "Yeah," I told him. "Men don't wear makeup," he said firmly, like it was a law, with his friends backing him up like a jury of the normal. "Where I come from, they do," I said, turning on my high heels and running away. At the mall, I'd see girls with their Farrah Fawcett hairdos shopping at Contempo, and all I could think was, "Where's my Nancy?" I was Sid Vicious looking for a Nancy Spungen. Eventually, I just ignored my cousins altogether. I'd sit in my room and play bass through an old amplifier which was half the size of the wall and made for a stereo instead of instruments. When I decided to come to the table for a meal, I wouldn't apologize or say grace. I'd ask Don things like, "Tell me about the suite, man. Do those guys do a lot of drugs?" Then I'd go out to the clubs and come home when I felt like it. If they tried to impose a single house rule on me, I'd tell them to fuck off. I was an arrogant, ungrateful little shit. So they kicked me out and I left in a rage. I was as mad at them as I was at my mother, and once again found myself alone and blaming everybody but myself. I found a one-bedroom apartment near Melrose Avenue and conned the landlady into letting me rent it without a deposit. I didn't pay her a penny for 18 months, even though I managed to hold on to my job at Music Plus for a little while. The store was heaven. Cocaine, pot, and hot chicks coming in all the time. I had a sign near the register, "Bass player looking for band." People would ask, "Who's the bass player?" When I told them it was me, they accepted that. They'd tell me about auditions and invite me to gigs. One of those guys was a rock singer and hairdresser, always a bad combination, named Ron, who needed a place to live. I let him stay with me. He had a bunch of girlfriends, and soon we had a small scene. I met a valley girl named Allie at Music Plus, and we'd all snort an elephant tranquilizer called cannabinol, drink beer, and hang out at a rock club called the Starwood. Then we'd head back to my cinder block apartment and fuck and listen to Todd Rundgren's Runt. I had all the free drugs, records, and sex I wanted. And I bought a car, a 49 Plymouth, that cost $100 and was so shitty that when I went to pick Allie up at her parents' house, I'd have to drive backward up the hill because the motor couldn't handle it any other way. Then I got fired from Music Plus. The manager accused me of stealing money from the till, and I told him to fuck off. "Fuck you," he yelled back. I went into a blind rage, punching him in the face and stomach. I kept yelling, "What are you gonna do?" There was not a lot he could do. He only had one arm. The worst part about it is that he was right. I was stealing money from the till. I was a volatile kid who did not like to be told off, even when I was wrong. I eventually found a job selling Kirby vacuum cleaners over the telephone, but I couldn't seem to close a single deal. One of the other salesmen told me about a carpet cleaning job that was open to anyone with a car. So I took the steam cleaning job with the sole intention of going to people's houses and setting up the steamer in front of their bedroom door to keep them away while I raided their medicine cabinets and took all their drugs. For extra money, I'd bring a water bottle with me and tell people that it was Scotchgard, and I could seal their carpets so that the dirt wouldn't stick. I explained that the going price was $350 for the whole house, but since I was a student trying to work his way through college, I'd do it for $100 if they paid me in cash and kept it quiet. So I'd walk around the house spraying water and stealing whatever I thought they wouldn't notice for a few days. I was starting to make a lot of money, but I still didn't pay my rent. The apartment complex was like a Skid Row version of Melrose Place. My neighbors were a young couple, and when they broke up, I started fucking the wife until the husband moved back in. Then I befriended him, and we decided to deal Quaaludes because they were in fashion that month. I probably ended up swallowing as many as I sold. At the same time, I started to put my first band together with Ron and some friends of his, a girl named Rex, who sang and drank like Janis Joplin, and her boyfriend, Blake, or something. We called ourselves Rex Blade, and we looked good. We had white pants that laced up the front and back, tight black tank tops, and ratty hair that looked like Leif Garrett on a bad day. We rehearsed in an office building next to where the Mau Maus practiced. Unfortunately, we didn't sound nearly as good as we looked. In retrospect, the only thing Rex Blade had going for it was that it was a good excuse to take drugs, and it earned me the right to tell girls I was in a band. As usual, my shitty attitude made this period in my life a short one. I think everything I'd experienced was always so short-term and transient that if anything remained stable for too long, I'd panic and self-destruct. So I got thrown out of Rex Blade for making the classic young rock band mistake that so many others have made before me and will make until the end of time. This happens when you first start writing songs. Your words seem very important, and you have your own vision that doesn't accommodate anyone else's. You are too narcissistic to realize that the only way to get better is by listening to other people. This problem was compounded by my stubbornness and volatility. If I was Rex or Blake, I would have thrown myself out of that band too, along with all the other little three-chord wonders I thought were such masterpieces. Days later, the police knocked on my door and threw me out in the street. After a year and a half of not paying rent, I had finally been evicted. I moved into a garage I found in the classifieds for $100 a month. I slept on the floor with no heater and no furniture. All I had was a stereo and a mirror. Every morning I'd swallow a handful of crosstops and drive to make the 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. shift at a factory in Woodland Hills, where we dipped computer circuit boards in some sort of chemical that could eat your arm off. After working there, playing Pong all day, and fighting with the Mexicans, not unlike the diversions I would later enjoy with my half-Mexican, half-blonde lead singer, I'd drive straight to Magnolia Liquor on Burbank Boulevard and work from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. Before leaving, I'd stuff as many bottles of booze as I could fit in my boots and drive an hour to my garage. I'd guzzle the stuff and stand in front of the mirror, fan out my thickening black hair, twist my mouth into a sneer, sling my guitar around my neck, and rock out, trying to look like Johnny Thunders from the New York Dolls until I passed out from exhaustion and alcohol. Then I'd wake up, pop more pills, and start all over again. It was all part of my plan. I was going to work my ass off until I had enough money to buy the equipment I needed to start a band that would either be insanely successful or attract tons of rich chicks. Either way, I'd be set up so that I'd never have to work again. For extra cash, whenever someone came in to buy liquor, I'd only ring up half the price I charged them. I'd write down the amount I didn't ring up on a slip of paper and put it in my pants. Then, at the end of the night, I'd total up the money I'd fucked the store out of, pocket it, and close up, 80 bucks the richer. My accounting was never over or under by more than a dollar. I'd learned my lesson at Music Plus. One night, while I was strung out on speed and alcohol, a slouched-over rocker with black hair walked into Magnolia Liquor. He looked like a creepy version of Johnny Thunders, so I asked him if he played music. He nodded that he did. "What are you into?" I asked. "The Paul Butterfield Blues Band and Jeff Beck," he answered. "What about you?" I was disappointed that this hunchback who looked so demented had such lame, predictable taste. I rattled off the list of the cool music I was into. The Dolls, Aerosmith, MC5, Nugent, Kiss. And he just looked at me contemptuously. "Oh," he said dryly, "I'm into real players." "Fuck you, man," I shot back, pompous little shit. "No, fuck you," he said, not angrily but firmly and confidently, as if I would soon see the error of my ways. "Get out of my store, asshole," I pretended like I was going to leap over the counter and kick his Jeff Beck loving ass. "If you want to see a real guitar player, come see me tonight. I'm playing down the street." "Get the fuck out of here. I've got better things to do." but of course I went to see him. I may have hated his taste, but I liked his attitude. That night, I stole a pint of Jack Daniels, stuffed it into my sock, and got drunk outside the bar. Inside, I saw that gnarly little leather Quasimodo playing slide guitar with a microphone stand, running it up and down the neck as fast as he could. He was going crazy, beating the shit out of that guitar as if he had just caught it sleeping with his girlfriend. I'd never seen anyone play guitar like that in my life. And he was wasting his talent with a band that looked like abandoned Allman Brothers. After the show, we sat down and got drunk together. I was humbled by his playing and decided I'd forgive him for his shitty taste in music. We talked on the phone a few times afterward, then I lost track of him. I began moving through bands like Crosstops. I'd go to auditions listed in the recycler, join for a day, and then never show up again. I eventually learned to leave my bass in the car trunk when I first walked in to meet a band. If they had no vibe, which was almost always the case since they were all Lynyrd Skynyrd and I was Johnny Thunders, I'd tell them I had to run to the car to get my gear and that I'd split. But persistence paid off, and I answered an ad for a band called Garden or Soul Garden or Hanging Garden or Hanging Soul. They were a bunch of shady-looking guys with long black hair, which was more or less what I looked like. However, they played terrible Doors-like psychedelic jam rock, and I split. But I kept running into the band's guitarist, Lizzie Gray, at the Starwood. He had long curly hair, a tube top, and high heels. A cross between Alice Cooper and a rattlesnake. He was either the most beautiful woman or the ugliest man I'd ever seen, with the sole exception of Tiny Tim. We soon discovered that we both had a passion for Cheap Trick, Slade, The Dolls, Old Kiss, and Alice Cooper, especially Love It to Death. It was through Lizzie that I joined my first band in Hollywood. Lizzie had been invited by a big, intimidating bastard named Blackie Lawless to play in a group called Sister, which also included a raving mad guitarist, Chris Holmes. I knew Blackie from the Rainbow Bar and Grill. He'd just stand in the middle of the room, tall with long black hair, black leather pants, and black eye makeup, and emit some kind of bad boy magnetic power that would soon have dozens of girls stuck to his side. Somehow Lizzie talked Blackie into letting me play bass and Sister, rounding out a very ugly and menacing band. We practiced on Gower Street in Hollywood, where the Dogs rehearsed. Blackie was an amazing songwriter, and despite the fact that he was cold and shut down, he was inspirational to talk to because he was into making an impression, not just with music, but with appearance. He was into eating worms and drawing pentagrams on stage, anything to get a reaction from the audience. We'd record songs like Mr. Cool in the studio, then sit around and talk about how we were going to look on stage or what he was trying to express with his songs for hours. But Blackie fell into the class of people like me who saw life as a war, and he always had to be the general. The rest of us were supposed to be good soldiers and nothing more. So Blackie and I soon began